That Podcast Thing presents Home Movie Club, originally recorded July 2017, episode number 11, They're Taking the Hobbits to Isengard!
Hello and welcome to Home Movie Club. This time we are looking at 2002's The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, part 2 of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. This time, as always, I am delighted to say I am joined by Joe Carter.
Meow.
With added cats. Daisy Swaffer.
Hi.
And, as always, my darling wife, Sammy Kelsch.
Hi.
Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. As most people will probably know, this is the second book in J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings trilogy. And as such, makes no bones, and the film makes no apology for being literally a part two of three. You could not watch this film without watching the first one. You would have no idea what's going on. In fact, many people possibly have watched the first one and watched this one, and I have no idea what's going on. That's a different story. But opening thoughts. Joe, opening thoughts.
Well, the first movie is one of my favourites. I don't know why. I've watched it like 100 times. And I think this is the first film that's been very, very, very long that I've not been going, oh my God, how much time has this got left? It just sort of flowed naturally and it was quite cool.
Yeah, we did have a moment of how long has this film got left, but simply because we realised that we'd put it on quite late and it was a, it's a long film. It's nearly 3 hours. It is 3 hours, I'm not sure. And we put it on, it was like, oh, another hour and a half to go and it's nearly bedtime. But we persevered, so it's fine. Daisy, your thoughts?
This film suffered quite badly from, hey, we made a really long version that makes sense, and then we cut it down and cut out loads of stuff to make it only 3 hours, and a lot of it just didn't make sense as a result.
Yeah, I've seen mainly the extended cut, although I was watching this last night trying to remember what was taken out, and I couldn't necessarily say which scenes were definitely missing.
Yeah, same here. It's been too long since I've seen it.
The theatrical cut obviously is a good hour shorter than the extended edition.
There's a lot where they just took, like, here is 10 seconds from a scene and we'll put that in and expect people watching this version to just know what's going on, and it doesn't work. They'd have written it differently if they were writing it for that length instead of for the longer
version. I do wonder with a lot of this how much there is a assumption of pre-knowledge from people reading the books and... because there's an awful...
Well, I hope not, because I never did.
No, there's an awful lot of characters and an awful lot of things happening, and everybody kind of sounds the same sort of names, and they're all Old English or sort of fake Old English. And it is very sort of... You've got to pay attention with this film. If you don't pay attention, you quite easily get lost on what's happening.
Yeah, so this time I was paying attention much more than I have any other viewing, and I... By excluding any other knowledge that I had, I could not make sense of what was happening for quite a lot of it as a result.
Oh, dear.
I remember there being more with Merry and Pippin, but that was about it.
Sammy, your opening thoughts?
Opening thoughts. I think it's interesting watching this, as it is such an obvious sort of second piece of three in a serialized story, And to watch it independently of the other two, when I think subsequent to this film coming out, a few, you know, sort of in the intervening years, we've become so used to being able to just, like, binge watch stuff. Entire series of TV shows come out all at once.
Yeah.
So watching this, you know, as it would have come out in the theater without the context of the film that came before it or the film that came after it, you know, in fairly short order, it felt so much like, you know, flipping to page 100 of a book and kind of starting there and then stopping about, you know, sort of 2/3 before the end.
That's quite a good description, actually.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, the film was fairly fairly loyal to the source material, but actually there was quite a few changes, because in the books, and I don't know if anybody else has read the books, but...
Yes.
When you read the books, basically the whole thing with Sam and Frodo off into the wilds is a completely separate section. It's almost a little story in itself. And then you pretty much rewind time, go back and experience everything else that happened around the same time. And that is partly because I think the books were originally released in 6 parts or something like that, and there was sort of part one of chapter two sort of thing, and then part two, and it was all spread out, mainly because they were very big books, I think, more than anything. And yeah, so with the film, they obviously combined things into a slightly more, what you'd see as traditional timeline for a movie. But a lot of it was... yeah, a lot of it stuck to the source material. Some things were moved around slightly. The start of the third film, which we won't talk about here, is actually theoretically in the second book, but they moved that around to make more sense. And it did kind of end on a bit of a, off we go again. There was no resolution. It was literally just, and we continue our journey.
Yeah.
This viewing of this this film, to me, felt more than any other time I'd watched it, like this was Aragorn's story.
Mm.
I really got a strong sense of that through this, and I think it's because a lot of what was cut out from the extended version was not Aragorn stuff, leaving what was left as being predominantly Aragorn. But it felt like this is Aragorn's story without any character development for Aragorn, which was odd, and especially when it's 3 hours long.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of want to go back and watch the extended version again, but I might give it a few days before I do that, because...
Because we need to sleep.
This is true. We do indeed need to sleep, and we need to have lives and go to work, and...
there's only so many hours in an evening, and the extended version is a good 4 of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's get into the meat of this. Let's have a look at the plot of the film. And as always, spoilers... we are going to be talking about the film. If you haven't seen the film, go off and watch it and then come back to listen to this probably tomorrow, because it's going to be late by the time you've finished.
Can I say one thing before we start in on the story?
Of course you can.
Do you remember the trailers for this when it was coming out in cinema?
No.
Oh, no.
No. No.
Right. You see, this is the only thing about this film that annoyed me, is because this is one plot point and it's like a really big reveal in the books and it's like, oh my God, and yet... front and center in the goddamn trailer. Oh my God, Gandalf's still alive.
Yes, Return of
and
the White Wizard.
Really, really put me off.
Yeah, they did spoil
when they do
that.
Yeah, they. I don't remember the trailers, but yes, now I can see why that would be a, because that was a big thing. That was the whole return.
And they
of
did
the
reveal
Wizard.
Itself very well when they were in the film, with the merging of Ian McKellen and Christopher Lee was done very cleverly to make you go, is that? Oh, hang on, no, wow.
Yeah, so but no, it would kind of ruin it if it's spoiled by the trailer, yeah.
It was completely spoiled by the trailer. It was, I mean, obviously that's I knew what rude. Was going to happen because I'd read the books, but it was more the, if you don't, that's a pretty major plot point, and that's then right there in the trailer, and that's not how you do film.
Although, as we're about to talk about the opening scene, maybe people might have, when they saw the opening scene, thought, oh, well, this is the extra Gandalf that we're getting, and thought that was the end of it at that point.
I don't know, possibly. I suspect there's an entire series of podcasts about going and looking at trailers and then trying to work out what they're on about, and then seeing the final film and going, okay, especially with things like Rogue One, where half the trailer doesn't even appear in the film.
Well, there was in this, the trailer for this one had something as well that didn't appear in the film. It was Eowyn somewhere brandishing a sword. I'm not sure where she was, but it was like, ooh, wow, she's like doing some proper fighting type stuff, and then they just cut and rewrote that section. So in the trailer, not in the movie.
There's that, I get the names mixed up. Eowyn, is that the blonde haired horse lady?
Yes.
Right, because she does that in the third film, doesn't she?
She has more of an active role in the third film, but I don't know if that was...
Yeah.
She brandishes
this
sword.
Yeah, well, this was like inside a building in a different
place.
Okay. It was fair not enough. What was in the third film.
No.
Okay, fair enough.
The plot of the film. As we have mentioned, the film basically starts with, it's a flashback from the first film, although it's not a flashback that tells you anything if you haven't seen the first film. Gandalf fighting the Balrog on the Bridge of Khazad Dûm.
You shall not pass!
Yep.
Now that, ladies and gentlemen, is acting.
Someone had to do it.
Yes.
Obviously, in the original, or at least in the first film, we see Gandalf fall, and then it goes back to the story of Sam and Frodo and the rest of the Fellowship. In this version, we see the fall, and we see the sight of Gandalf and the Balrog battling each other as they fall down a seemingly endless chasm.
I have a question about this.
Yeah?
Where does Gandalf get that big sword he's using from? Didn't he have a staff?
Yeah, the sword sort of just appears. I mean, he did have it on his belt, but yeah, I don't know how it suddenly became flying. That didn't make a lot of sense.
Because I was watching that going, this is badass, but where is the sword from?
Yeah, I might have to watch that again and see if I can work out where it comes from.
Did they cut the bit that explains that, probably?
I think they must have.
But he just him drawing the sword as he fell, yeah.
Wouldn't be paying quite, would be wrapped up enough in the action not to be asking where did the sword come from.
Yeah, and I'd like them to tell us how long this whole thing lasted for as well. Like, the fall to the water is obviously a really long time, but how long? And then how long until the end of the scene?
Yeah, it doesn't really give you that sort of timescales, and I think that's partly done on purpose, but... Mm. Yeah, so they fall, and eventually they fall into a large underground lake, and as they hit the water, Frodo suddenly wakes, as if from a bad dream.
Probably.
Yeah, that was quite
a
good.
Yes.
I did like the cut, how the scene switched in this. It did sort of seem.
Because I read that as at that exact moment that they hit the water was that exact moment that Frodo wakes up. In which case, it's been, what, months they've been falling for? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was more just to be, well, I guess it could be interpreted either way, but I interpreted it as being that was just Frodo almost sort of dreaming it and imagining this is what happened. But he obviously wasn't there, so I don't know. But yeah, so Sam and Frodo are trying to make their way to Mordor. Mm. One does not simply walk into Mordor, apparently. So they've reached as far as the rocky region of Emil Muel, which is one of the many names that I'm probably going to mispronounce or annoy Tolkien scholars with by saying
Yay!
Wrong. So yes, they're lost, and they sort of a rocky kind of just maze full of mist and dampness, and they realise they're going round and round in circles. Mm. They're sort of despairing when suddenly they are attacked by Gollum, who is obsessed with the ring following his previous ownership.
My precious.
My precious is said 15 times during the course of this film.
Ooh.
Thank you for counting.
Fun fact.
Gollum attacks Frodo and Sam. However, the hobbits manage to subdue him, and Sam binds him with the
Elven
rope.
Well, they were lying
in
wait for him. They realised he was there, and they pretended to sleep,
yes.
Waiting
yes,
to pounce.
Yes,
which I thought
sure.
was actually like the cleverest I'd seen these two hobbits be up until this point. I was quite actually impressed with their trap-laying ability there.
Wasn't quite sure how they knew that he was there. But, I mean, they knew they were being followed, but again, this is... These are a couple of hobbits from the Shire. They're not exactly trained in this sort of thing. So.
Yeah, but there's no animals or anything around there, is there? So I think if you hear anything, it's pretty obvious that there's someone else with you.
They capture him and bind him with the rope that was given to them by Galadriel.
So why doesn't Gollum just take the rope off of his head? Because when Sam takes it off, it comes off like really easily.
I think, it burns. I think the whole point is it's elven, so therefore it's unpleasant to him. But yes, you'd think that would make him even more impetus to just, you know, slightly slide the hitch knot and just take it off.
That's another thing that made no sense. I didn't understand why Gollum didn't just take it off.
It was also a magical rope.
Which they didn't tell me.
It wasn't super obvious based on what we could see in this scene that it was magical. Like, if they'd just... put some magical post-production onto it. Just a little bit of a sort of
I didn't know that
it would make sense
magical.
That he's like, it burns! But I remember seeing this in the cinema and thinking, why? But it's just a rope, isn't it? Why does it burn? Because it wasn't obvious unless you remembered that somehow it's like elf magic or whatever.
Yeah, I didn't remember that they'd got a rope from Galadriel, and I wouldn't have thought that that was necessarily the rope from Galadriel had I remembered they'd got
I think
a rope
Gollum
there.
Does say it's elven and it burns. I mean, there's a section, I don't know if it's this film or the next film, or whether it's just actually on the extended version, where they are climbing and the rope, they climb down with the rope and then it unties itself.
Yeah, that wasn't in this version.
No, is it in this film though?
No.
Or is it in the next film?
I think that's when they're climbing the steps to Shelob.
All right, so that's the next film anyway. So again, yes, no explanation of what this rope is or why it's supposedly magical. Sam basically doesn't trust Gollum, and who can blame them? But Frodo, obviously being the ring bearer, has sympathy for Gollum because he knows what Gollum's gone through, and basically takes pity on him. He also knows that they need a guide to get out of here, and they assume Gollum knows where they're going. So they release Gollum and persuade him to take them to the Black Gate of Mordor, which is the main entrance into Mordor, which is where you don't walk.
Well, unless you're an orc.
Yes, or an Eastling or something, and you're allowed in.
Whatever those, yeah. Is that what the human-looking ones that wear the cool helmets are?
The Easterlings, yes.
Easterlings. That's never explained. And I'm just like, they look human and not orcs, so why are they on the bad dude's side? I don't understand, they never tell me. I feel like if you can't explain it to me properly, just don't include it unless it's plot pivotal. And they weren't plot pivotal, so don't include them. It's just confusing.
Yeah. And this is we get this point where we're suddenly back into Rohan. And this is one of these things with this film, because originally, as I said, it was written as separate sections where you had all of Sam and Frodo's, then you had all of everybody else's. Because they've mixed it all together, we get an awful lot, certainly later in the film, of now we're here, now we're there, now we're here, now we're back here again. And it's sort of like, hang on, where are we? What's going on?
Which is more confusing when the places look very similar as well.
They all look like New Zealand. I mean, that's just shocking.
It's almost as though it was filmed there.
We go to Rohan and we see a pack of Uruk-hai and orcs running across a grassy landscape with their captives, Merry and Pippin, two hobbits from the previous film who have been, I guess, there as comic relief. They're being pursued by our heroes, Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli the Dwarf, which apparently that's 3 days of running, and every time we switch from one shot to another, Gimli magically becomes close to them again.
Yes, because he's like, dwarves are not made for long distance, we're really good at sprinting, though.
Yes, so lately the dwarf is struggling to keep up, and yet every time we see a change in shot, suddenly he's got back in close proximity again.
He's got, like, legs that are half or less the size of like Legolas's, and he's running like twice as fast to try to go the same speed, and they've got no pity for them at all. They're just like, whatevs, keep up, dude.
Yep, so they're constantly running. They have a situation where Legolas, using his elf eyes, which I assume just means he can see better, works out that the they're taking the hobbits to Isengard.
You said the thing.
Where Saruman is marshalling his forces to do the bidding of Sauron.
Can I just take a moment here to acknowledge the fact that when Davey and I were watching the film and that scene happened, we both went, way! As soon as he said, they're taking the hobbits to Isengard!
And for anybody not knowing what we're talking about, I will put a link in the show notes to the video
in
question.
I was going to say, you've got to put that in the show notes.
Again, though, I have a problem here. They don't tell us what Isengard is or what that, why that's of any kind of significance. Well, they're taking them to Isengard. Well, I don't know. Where did you think they were taking them? Is there,
just
is
based
this
on
different?
The name, Isengard sounds like it could conceivably be a nice northern European city, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But Isengard has been visited before.
Yeah. Right, so let's assume, as is actually the case, that I haven't seen Fellowship of the Ring for a year, which is when the last one came out. I'm going to need them to actually tell me the significance of Isengard at that point.
Yeah, I think this is the problem, because it is a part two of three. They had to basically make a decision on whether they're going to explain everything again and really slow it down.
All it would have taken was a few extra words. They're taking the hobbits to Isengard. That must be to Saruman. You know, just something to give it some context.
I mean, yes, you can see why that would be, you know, and I can fully appreciate where you're coming from on that one. But also, I think, you know, this film is 3 hours long as it is, and potentially 4 hours long with extended cut. If you spent the entire time going, oh, we're going here because this is where this is, and we're doing this because of this, I think the film would be just...
We do then cut to Saruman at Isengard, but I feel like he needs a sign behind him saying, welcome to Isengard, so that I can know that that's where they were talking about. They're digging up orcs. What?
No, they're birthing orcs.
What?
The Uruk-hai.
They're in, like, birth sacks, and they're digging them out of the earth. What?
It's magic.
I've seen this film many a time. I've seen both versions, and I still have no idea what's happening there.
Does that happen in the books? I feel like they should be saying something about that, because it's not normal. Is there loads of, if they just excavate forever, is all of the ground that everyone's underneath there just covered in birthing sack?
It's Uruk-hai all the way down.
Ew.
Like, how far does that go for? How many are under there?
I think in the book it's supposed to be the Uruk-hai are basically a fusion of elves and orcs. But I don't think it's actually explained in the books how this happens either.
How does that lead to that weird birthing process? What?
I don't know.
What?
I don't know.
I spent this film very confused.
Theoden, King and Lord of Rohan, is under the spell of Saruman and being controlled by Grima Wormtongue, who is whispering in his ear.
So Wormtongue is being paid for his service to Saruman with the fee of Eowyn. Ew.
Yeah.
And he doesn't seem to have been very successful at actually being given that prize either.
So with Rohan in activity due to the spell being held over Theoden, we get a situation where orcs and wild men are roaming the plains of Rohan.
Boo.
And burning and killing at will.
Boo hiss.
But Éomer is onto him. Is that how you say it? I don't know.
Éomer, yes.
Éomer and Éowyn, they really like to name people very similarly.
They're very, I think they're old English names, yeah.
Yeah.
Fake old English, in fairness.
So the orcs and wild men are roaming free and they're attacking villages and they also kill the king's only son, Theodred, who is unfortunately badly wounded and is prone to die.
He has a very small part in this film.
He does have a very small part. However, even the death of his son isn't enough to break the spell on Theoden.
That is no reflection on his parenting, I think, just that the spell's really strong.
Yes.
No, he's a nice guy and he's trying his best in very difficult circumstances.
Yeah.
Theoden's nephew, Éomer, interrogates Grima and realizes that, well, he's kind of onto him anyway and realizes that what he is after, what Grima is after, is his sister, Éowyn.
Ew.
However, Grima does have people under his control and so he banishes Éomer and says he is being banished from the lands of Rohan on the pain of death if he ever returns. But we never see him actually leave Rohan. He's always in Rohan anyway, so he's not gone very far.
He seems to have a varying degree of number of people with him as well.
Yeah.
It goes from, like, here is quite a small group to later on when he's got a massive army.
But I think that's part of what he's doing is going around and collecting.
He's going, are you with Saruman? No, join me then. Hop on.
He is raising his own army.
Yeah, but they don't tell us that.
No.
Or show us that. No. They basically just leave that for us to assume. And I don't assume anything with this film because none of it makes sense.
So we then start getting the first crossover of plot lines. We have Éomer and his loyal Rohirrim ambush and kill a squad of orcs and Uruk-hai. And this is the same squad of orcs and Uruk-hai that were transporting the hobbits to Isengard.
Oh no, does that mean the hobbits are dead?
Well, we don't see them narrowly escape or we don't see them die. We just see the battle.
Oh no.
We will be left in suspense and assume they are dead.
Crushed by a horse.
Shortly afterwards, or I assume it's the morning after, Aragorn, Legolas and Gimli catch up with the Rohirrim, speak to Éomer, and Éomer says there are no survivors and that everybody they attacked was dead. So yes, Merry and Pippin are dead.
They would have appeared just like children to you. Nope, yes. Didn't see him, must be dead.
Yeah, didn't see him, must have died.
Yeah.
So the three heroes go to the battle site. However, Aragorn uses his tracking skills to...
But first of all, Aragorn kicks that helmet, that orc helmet, and he goes, because he's so annoyed at the hobbits being dead. But actually, Viggo Mortensen is going, because that broke two of his toes.
It did indeed.
Wow.
Oh, no. That was the fourth time Peter Jackson kept getting him to try kicking the helmet because he wanted the helmet to go nearer to the camera. And on the fourth time, it broke two of Viggo's toes. So they stopped at that one and went, no, that'll do. Thanks, Viggo.
Yep.
You're the best.
Yep. Yeah. Thanks for that. That one, we'll just put it in afterwards. We'll CG it in.
Then all those wide shots that we had of the three of them running to try to catch up with the orcs, all three of the actors in those wide shots were injured. Viggo from kicking that helmet. The Gimli's stunt guy was actually the one doing the running, Brad Beatty, and he had a knee injury. And Orlando Bloom had broken a couple of ribs from falling off a horse. So whenever they yelled Kurt on those wide shots, the three of them were just like, ow, oh, ah, oh, God, bless them.
That's hilarious. Said making films is glamorous?
But it's dangerous.
Fun facts from your fun fact machine over here. Hi.
So we have Aragorn tracking the path of the hobbits, and they realise they've gone into Fangorn Forest. And then we sort of swipe back a few hours, and we see Merry and Pippin escape from the battle and indeed go into the forest.
I really enjoyed that scene where it's like Aragorn's going, oh, and I can see from this little indentation here that a hobbit was falling over here and scooching out the way here, and they're intercutting it with us seeing that happen. I really liked the way that they did that, though. I did think that Aragorn was mostly just making it up as he went along, because it was like, how could you tell that?
But yeah, I mean, there was one shot that was blatantly a hobbit footprint, but frankly, you know, anything could have happened.
Yeah.
And there were horses running backwards and forwards and dead bodies, and then the rear...
He's an expert tracker. He was raised by elves.
He has elite skills for tracking, and this was his way of proving that, because we get to see intercut with him that it's actually right. What he's saying is somehow true.
So Merry and Pippin run into the forest, tracked by a lone orc. They try and climb a tree, and in doing so, one of the two is pulled back down to the ground. Pippin, climbing up the tree, shouts for Merry, and in doing so, wakes Treebeard, because the one tree they climb just happens to be an Ent.
There are, by the end of it, a lot of Ents, so I do wonder how sparsely scattered out the Ents are as to, you know, what percentage chance it was that Pippin chose an Ent to climb there.
Yeah.
Maybe Ents just have particularly like good handholds for climbing, and it meant that the Ent was more likely to be picked to be climbed. I don't know.
Possibly. Yeah, maybe they actually just really like to be climbed, and so they grow specifically climbable limbs. Maybe that's their idea of
Treebeard seemed
friends.
Quite happy carrying these two hobbits around for the rest of the film.
They climb Treebeard. Treebeard wakes up, squashes the orc flat, grabs the two hobbits, accuses them being orcs. And although they flatly deny it, he says that the White Wizard will be able to say whether they're orcs or not.
Oh no, that must be Saruman.
Saruman, so far at this point, is the only White Wizard we've seen. So that is the indication or the general idea that Saruman is the White Wizard.
And that'll be the first and last time that those hobbits are ever accused of being orcs.
Those particular ones, anyway.
It's not something hobbits are often accused of being.
No. So we switch back to the Sam and Frodo storyline. Gollum has led them out of the rocky area and into the dead marshes, which was lovely, apparently, full of mosquitoes, and everybody got eaten as they were filming this.
Ew.
Can I just track back to the last scene?
Mm.
Because I have a fun fact.
Yay! Fun fact away!
So, you know Treebeard?
I am aware of him.
Treebeard was voiced by John Rhys-Davies, who played Gimli, and they didn't even use electronic distortion for his voice. They just had the actor speak in his, like, the lowest pitch of his natural voice and gave him a wooden megaphone. I love that.
Nice.
I've never worked out why they gave John Rhys-Davies that character as well. I mean, his performance is fantastic. It's fine. And you don't necessarily know it's the same person most of the time. But were they running short of actors? Did they not have someone else they could use?
Maybe it meant they didn't have to pay another actor's fee.
Yep.
I don't know. It just struck me as a bit... It's always struck me as a bit weird that they use the same actor in two separate roles in the same film.
I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I liked it.
Back to the Frodo, Sam and Gollum storyline. We see that Gollum has finally led them out of the rocky maze, and they have made it into the dead marshes, which are lovely. Not the place you want to spend a holiday, definitely.
Hmm.
As they're going through the marshes, they realise that there are dead bodies just lying under the water. And these are the...
They are called the Dead Marshes.
This is true. Yeah. So we see men and elves and orcs just lying just underneath the surface of the marshes. And these are apparently the spirits of the previous battle of the... See, this is something, again, from the first film. The first part of the first film is a big battle when Saruman was initially defeated. And these are supposedly the bodies of that battle.
Oh, they're from that battle. Okay. I still don't get why they're there. Or what the entire point of this whole scene was, in fact. Why do we have this scene? Why?
We have this scene because it's in the book.
That just doesn't give us any development to the story at all. It does, because
what happens is Frodo becomes pretty much entranced by one of the dead bodies and falls into the marsh and is pretty much drowning. It's sort of being pulled down by sort of the haunted shades from the dead bodies. And yet then he is rescued by Gollum. And I think that's the point of the scene, is to show that he's starting to trust Gollum more because, well, he's just saved his life, so...
Well, Gollum saved the ring rather than him.
Yeah, it's true.
It didn't feel like there was any development between the two of them there for me.
They continue through the marshes and suddenly they have to hide as one of the ring wraiths from the first film. Again, no explanation of what this is, where this comes from. Is seen flying on a fell beast, which is a big dragon-like, lizard-like creature
that has no
aerodynamic
scary.
Properties whatsoever.
The ringwraiths now have riding dragons. That is scary.
So we switch back to Fangorn Forest and we see Aragorn, Gimli and Legolas discovering that they're being followed by the White Wizard. They turn to attack him, but their attacks are futile, and then the White Wizard blinding them with unnatural light.
Oh, no.
Starts talking to them, and as you said, it sounds like Christopher Lee.
Well, here they gave Ian McKellen Christopher Lee's eyes, and they mixed in alternating intensity the two actors' voices so as to give us this confusion, and I thought they did that really well, and it would have been much better if they hadn't have spoiled it in the trailers, as you were saying, Joe.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that really bugged me.
So yes, they find that this is indeed Gandalf the Grey, or as he's been reborn, Gandalf the White. So Gandalf recognises his name, and then he speaks of his ordeal with the Balrog, so we again get more of the fight between the Balrog and Gandalf that ends with the Balrog being defeated and Gandalf dying.
Yeah,
I think is what we're supposed to take from the scene. However, he's not allowed to die. He is brought back because Gandalf is not a human. Gandalf is one of the ancient people.
He's a wizard, Harry.
He's a wizard, Gandalf. But yes, there is an awful lot in Tolkien mythology about the wizards. So you'll have, obviously, Saruman and Gandalf in this. We also see Radagast in, I think, may just be The Hobbit. He's mentioned, certainly, in the film somewhere. Radagast the Brown, played by Doctor Who. But again, that is just The Hobbit. I don't think he's in this at all.
No, he is just mentioned.
But the wizards of various colours are just, they're not human. They're something completely different, and I can't think what, because there's so much Tolkien lore that it just all merges into one. The four of them then leave Fangorn Forest with the knowledge that Pippin and Merry are safe with a big talking tree. And Gandalf summons Shadowfax, who is a big white horse, by whistling at him.
So, I was watching this going, this is a brilliant white horse, which I see they've done to coordinate with Gandalf's new look. This is very nicely done, but it's called Shadowfax. This seems like an odd name for a brilliant white horse. So I looked it up. Because I was like, did they just do this for the coordination or is this from the book? I'm confused. Shadowfax's coat in the book is described as silvery grey in daylight and hardly to be seen at night. And I think that actually therefore makes sense of the name, which doesn't really show in the brilliant white, but I get their coordinating look.
Yeah, it's more that, you know, it's all gone new and reborn and white. So they all get on their horses and proceed to Edoras, the home of Theoden and the Rohirrim. And now back to Sam, Frodo and Gollum. As I say, this film jumps around all over the place. They finally reach the Black Gate and find, unsurprisingly, that it's a big gate. that's heavily defended and there's no way for them to get in.
Yeah, I really don't know what they are expecting there.
No. There's a scene in a minute where Sam accuses Gollum of not telling them about the easier route in. And Gollum's going, well, you didn't ask. You asked to be led to the Black Gate. It's what I've done. You know, what do you expect?
Fair enough, yes.
Yeah. They observe a contingent of Easterlings from Rûn, apparently.
Yeah, this was where I was getting really confused about what? But they're human-looking, not orc-looking. I don't understand.
Yeah, so they consider sneaking in with the Easterlings, but that seems ridiculously unwise.
So are the Easterlings being, like, summoned from somewhere and, like, coming to Saruman's call or what?
Yes, I believe that is the whole thing. And we see further ones later on. We see other nations, armies coming towards Saruman's call.
Okay.
Sauron's call.
Too many people with similar names in this whole story franchise.
Yes.
Yeah. Like,
yes.
I want to go back in time and just have words with JRR about, you know, effective storytelling and making sure that everyone knows which characters you're talking about at any given time by giving them really distinctive names.
Yes.
Like, instead of having like a big bad called Sauron, and then also like an also really bad wizard called Saruman, who have fairly similar names with like several syllables in common, you could have called one of them like Bevan, and it wouldn't have wrecked the story.
Yeah. Mm. We really need to build a time machine just to achieve this one thing. Like, if you're going to go back and tinker with history, this is what needs changing. Goodness me.
I feel like millions of moviegoers and millions of book readers would thank you.
Yes. This whole sequence, though, where we're at, where I did not buy this sequence with the cloak.
So we have a situation where they're trying to make their way into the gate. Gollum says there's an easier way of doing it, but Sam has creeped up and miraculously, for some reason, the rock he's sitting on shifts and he falls down the side of the mountain towards the Easterlings.
Because of course he does.
Because he does. For dramatic falls. And then Frodo runs down after him and tries to free him, but a couple of the army spot the disturbance and walk towards where Sam is now trapped under rocks. And so to escape, they get Frodo's cloak, which was given to him by the elves, and throws the cloak over the two of them. And it sort of turns into what looks like a boulder.
It looks exactly like a boulder when he's just literally quickly pulled it over the two of them. And those Easterlings were walking up to there with, like, there was no other movement in the area. It was really obvious where they were.
And the cloak was three times as big as it was when he was wearing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a movie magic thing, but...
It's a magic cloak. It's supposed to hide them from when they need hiding.
They weren't telling me that cloak was magic. If they told me it then, oh, it's a good job we had this magic cloak, then I'd been like, oh, okay, magic cloak. I buy this a lot more.
Yes, they did say the magic cloak because at the beginning of the film, they were like, they got the cloaks and, you know, they would hide them from sight.
They were definitely given them in the first film.
That may have been the first film, but either which way, it was explained.
But not in this film, and that's the whole thing. If you haven't seen the first one for over a year, and you've only seen the first one once, you're going to be confused.
Yeah, I needed them to go, phew, thank goodness we had that magic cloak.
So they managed to use their movie magic cloak, is what I'm going to class it as, to hide from the Easterlings, who then walk off, and I assume they somehow managed to climb back up the near sheer cliff to where Gollum is, and make their way onwards. Switch back to Gandalf and Co., again, backwards and forwards, like I don't know what in this film.
Like a tennis match.
Yep. They are approaching the settlement. I was going to call it a town, but it's not really that big. Of Middleseld.
So this is where the king lives, right?
This is where the king is
and
spending
he's got,
his time,
like,
yes.
Hey, I've got this big palace-y type building. And it's like there's five houses there. This is a tiny little settlement. Yeah, this is where the king lives. I found that very odd.
Maybe he just prefers small town life.
Well, the Rohirrim are horsemen. They travel all around. I think the idea is that this is sort of almost his winter holiday home or his summer holiday home.
This is like his local hunting lodge or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this is not his main hall. This is literally where they spend, you know, summers.
It seems like it's his main hall from everything they're showing me in the film.
Yeah, and I think possibly that's coming from the books as opposed to the film, it says.
Again, another thing that I found confusing.
So Gandalf and co. Attempt to enter the chamber, but are told by Grima that they must leave their weapons, followed by a scene of them getting all their weapons out and handing them to them, which I think in the extended version is even longer and has even more weapons.
Oh yeah, and it has Legolas pulling knives out of all places and people looking amused.
Yep.
I just remembered that because I was like, oh, I'm sure there were more knives when
there were,
I watched
certainly
this
in the
last
extended
time.
Version. However, Gandalf manages to convince the guard that he can keep his staff because he is an old man.
And it's his walking stick.
Even though they have just seen him literally ride in on a horse.
And apparently Wormtongue said that he told them specifically to take his staff as well.
True, but also the guard in question, it was kind of given that he wasn't strictly on Wormtongue's side.
Yeah.
And also I think there was a bit of Jedi hand waving.
Yeah, a little bit.
This is not the staff.
Yeah, sure, that blag, that's fine for me. I'll buy it. And you go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That gives me plausible deniability.
They enter the chamber, they quickly dispatch Wormtongue's guards, and then Gandalf uses his magic skills to try and exorcise the spirit of Saruman.
I wrote in my notes here, Gandalf is taking none of that.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He attempts to do it, it fails. Theoden speaks, or while Saruman speaks through Theoden, saying that he has no control. So Gandalf whips off his cloak and believes his purcell white robes.
It was the power of the white, wasn't it?
Yeah.
What I didn't understand here was yet another thing I didn't understand. The specific thing here that I didn't understand was why is Saruman is now possessing Theoden? This is new. What?
I think it's all part of the magic, but yeah, it was less obvious that this was happening until at this point.
Surely he didn't need Wormtongue doing anything if he was just possessing him. Then what was the point of Wormtongue at all?
He couldn't spend his entire focus possessing him, so Wormtongue was making sure he was under his spell, and then when he felt Gandalf trying to interfere, then he focused.
So he was just like popping by into this possession every now and again, telling Wormtongue a bit more stuff he wanted him to do, and then popping off again.
Yeah, sounds about right. You know, that's how I'd do it.
I feel like they really kind of sprung this he's possessing him thing on us, and that needed something a bit more to it before that point.
Hmm. Yeah.
So, as you said, Gandalf whips off his cloak and is now the White Wizard. And that isn't explained either, but I think from what I remember of the books, the colours are hierarchical.
Yeah.
So the White Wizard is always the sort of leader of the Order. And so what's basically happening is Saruman's being deposed.
It's a power play.
It's a power play. The whiter your cloak, the better your washing powder, the more power you have.
Yep.
So Saruman is driven from Theoden's mind by Gandalf. We have a scene where Bernard Hill has to stay very still for several hours as they change his makeup and morph him from an old decrepit man into a slightly less old decrepit man with a very yellow beard.
I thought they did that sequence very, very well. It was very subtly done.
It was very well done and it was very effective, but yeah, I wouldn't like to have been Bernard Hill because apparently it was an awful lot of sitting still and you know, people doing makeup things.
Yeah, it did look complicated.
Which nowadays would simply be two photos and a 4-hour CGI job.
And then the king gets handed a sword and this appears to be really significant and I don't know why no one explains it. I don't understand. It's confusing.
Yeah, the whole thing with the sword wasn't overly explained other than the fact that he is, I guess, they come from a sort of culture of warriors and to not have a sword in your hand is a slightly odd thing for a person of his stature. But yeah, no, it was a little bit.
If they're not going to explain it, don't put it in. There was no need for it. It's just confusing. And it just makes the film longer.
Theoden is freed of his spell and then realises that his son is missing and the fact that his son has been killed. And we get a scene where he is visiting the grave of his son, lamenting the fact that no parent should have to bury their child.
That was sad. Can I take a quick second just to appreciate the cinematography in that bit where, like, my son is dead and all that, yada, 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 where it just, the establishing shot of that flower.
Yeah.
That just that looked really beautiful. Nice. I thought that was a really nice sort of end to that scene. It was really beautifully shot, and I just, I just want to say kudos to the team for shooting it, because I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a well-acted scene. It's very effective.
I think it's one of my favourites in the film.
Despite everything, or perhaps because of what's happened, Theoden decides he doesn't actually want to risk open war with Saruman's forces, so gets his entire nation, which seems to be, as you said, about 12 houses, and moves them all to Helm's Deep.
But the number of people that were living in those houses, because that's a lot of people they've got on this trail. I don't know if they're passing more villages along the way and picking up more people or what, because
I'm gonna
they seem to grow.
Or those houses have huge basement apartments that
yeah,
we don't see.
Yeah, like that whole hill was just full of people inside it.
I think they probably were picking other people up, because they get to Helm's Deep and they get there and there's already a lot of people there anyway.
Yeah,
so I think there are.
They get told the inn is full and sorry, King, you can't come in. It's very sad.
Yeah, so they have to go and live in a stable.
Yeah,
and...
yeah.
Although they're horse people, they all live in stables anyway. So, so they decide to go to Helm's Deep. Gawandalf leaves to find Éomer. Because he knows they're going to need extra manpower.
But he doesn't tell anyone that's actually what he's doing.
No, he just rides off and says, I'll
be
back in 5 days.
And I'm going to tell you exactly when I'm going to be back, but I'm not going to tell you what I'm doing or what I'll be back with.
No.
Good luck.
Yeah. Have fun.
Yeah.
Bye.
Yay.
Never to be seen again. Last spotted on a beach somewhere in Acapulco.
Yeah.
Wormtongue is spared death and flees back to Orthanc and tells Saruman that he's lost his grip. Although Saruman must have known that because he was there when the spell was broken. But in revenge, Saruman decides to destroy the nation of Rohan.
As you do.
And we're now back to Frodo, Sam and Gollum. We are in Ithilien, apparently, although this is just sort of open woodland and area. And we have the scene where Gollum shows his true spit personality and the Sméagol side of it tries to and successfully manages to banish Gollum from his mind.
Leave now and never come back.
It was well done for what was a 2002 CGI character, but it's not aged particularly well, I don't think. But
I thought it still looked good.
The whole thing with Gollum is very impressive for its time. I mean, it doesn't stack up to... current technologies, but then that's understandable. It's, 15 years old, so...
It didn't feel jarring like other CG of that age does.
Mm-hmm. No. And I also like the fact that we never saw Gollum in the Fellowship of the Ring, the first film, because they knew that they couldn't have pulled it off.
Yeah.
So they kind of just held back until they were sort of getting to the point where it would work. So Gollum has been banished, and we are left with Sméagol, who is trying to do good by capturing... rabbits and having conversations with Sam about what potatoes are.
They were adorable.
Potatoes.
Yeah.
I gotta say, Sméagol there was adorable.
Yeah. So whilst they're arguing about potatoes, chips, and how to cook rabbits, Frodo wanders off, hearing a sound, and sees a column of Southrons. Southrons? Southrons. Another particularly unnamed, unexciting bunch of foreign armies on the way to see Saruman.
Southerners.
Southrons. I don't know. Got it written down. I don't know how it's pronounced. It was never actually named in the film. But they had Oliphants, which were basically big elephants with four tusks.
Yes.
Which will make an appearance in the next film again.
Is that
however,
the one where... it only counts as one, or was that in this film? Because
that was in the
confused.
Next one.
Okay, they didn't cut that out then.
No, that was in the next film. The column of Southrons are attacked by a ambush of soldiers of Gondor, and at the same time they capture Sam and Frodo. Although at this point we don't know who is capturing them.
Yeah, I was really confused by who this
Robin
was,
Hood, by the look of it,
and who they were for, and what on earth. I was confused. I know that's been a bit of a theme. I was confused.
At this point, though, we don't think we're supposed to know. I can't remember if they had the Tree of Gondor on their armour or not. Some of them certainly did, so you might have picked up from that, but it wasn't actually revealed who they were until they revealed
I would have to have been paying really close attention to Sean Bean's armor in the first film of a year ago to have picked up on the Tree of Gondor is on their armor. Well, that's the same as Boromir, and he was from Gondor, which I wouldn't remember because it was a year ago.
Yeah, and the Tree of Gondor wasn't really in it until the third film either, yeah. So... yeah, that happens. And then we go back to Rohirrim and we see the column of refugees making their way to Helm's Deep, and they are attacked by Saruman's wargs and their orc riders.
But not before Eowyn and Aragorn get some quality flirting in.
And then we have a time of Aragorn just thinking about his other half and the first appearance of Liv Tyler in the most underused role in this entire film.
Yeah, this was weird. I wasn't quite sure what was going on here.
Yeah, this was part of the whole, so this is Aragorn's story without any actual Aragorn character development, and this just felt really shoehorned for no reason and didn't make any sense.
It just made the movie slightly longer.
Part of the problem is that Liv Tyler's character was shoehorned in the first place, because she's not in the books.
Yeah.
She's in there. The whole idea of an elf lady and a human ranger is actually a story from legend that is in the Silmarillion. It's not in this book at all. And so they sort of took that and shoehorned it into this, just so there was actually more than, you know, no female characters at all in the first film. Because this story and the original story is ridiculously... male heavy.
Well, they had to add someone into The Hobbit as well, because otherwise it would have had no women in.
Yeah, again, they had to add people into all of these films because there was just... the original books were written in whenever they were written, and they were boy stories, and there was no women in them, because obviously boys don't like reading about women or some such
women
junk.
Can't be role models for men.
Yes, so they're attacked by wargs. And an unhappy Eowyn, who is in the books, to be fair, she is actually in the books.
Yay!
Is, instead of being able to fight, which is what she wants to do, she is tasked with seeing her people safely to Helm's Deep.
Which she does very well.
She does very well. And actually, you know, someone's got to do it, and you may as well be someone you trust to do it.
At least she's being given the task of being a leader, even if it's, you know, a simple job.
Not that simple. They could get attacked again in 5 minutes.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah,
important.
However, during this battle, the wargs kill several people, and Aragorn is dragged off the edge of a cliff.
Oh, he's dead!
He's dead!
So much for that, boy!
It's a good job we just had that weird dream sequence thing with Arwen, because now he's dead.
So we see him getting dragged up the side of the cliff and then over the edge and onto a crash mat a foot and a half below, because that ledge wasn't actually a mountain. It was literally just a bit of rock.
So normally in these fight scenes, I get quite cringy at the way that they keep using Gimli as the butt of the joke, quite literally. It just seems to be a constant barrage of short jokes for him, which I feel very uncomfortable about.
Are you pro-dwarf? Is that what we're saying?
I'm saying it's not very nice to constantly make someone the butt of the jokes because of their race.
As a certified short person, I am with you on this.
But I did like his comedy moment in this fight, where he was constantly being buried under an increasing amount of orcs and wargs, and every time one of them would die either from him or someone else, and the pile would be even bigger, and he was getting more and more squashed. That was a comedy moment I could get on board with.
Yep, fair enough. There is a lot of dwarf tossing and short jokes and getting boxes and things like that.
Yep, and they just, like, once would have been funny, and they do it every time, and it just makes me cringe.
What we really want is a film about nothing but dwarves. And, we don't. That's called The Hobbit, and that was terrible.
Do three of them.
Yes. That was really terrible.
This warg goes over the cliff, taking Aragorn with it, and Aragorn falls into a raging river several meters below.
Dead.
And is dead.
They should have learnt from the whole Gandalf thing. Oh, he's dead. Oh, no, he's not. But they've gone, no, he's dead. Dead. Can't see the body, but dead. Tote's dead.
Yeah, Tote's dead. Leave him to it. So they all carry on to Helm's Deep. And then the next scene we see strikes me as the most hilarious scene in the film. Wormtongue is talking to Saruman about how they're going to attack Helm's Deep. He shows him the black powder, so it's a gunpowder type thing. And then Wormtongue says that they need to have thousands of people to attack the
Tens of thousands
of people to attack the castle. And then Saruman just leads him out the back door, and there's this huge army out there making so much noise. It's like, how did you not see that before?
Yeah, Wormtongue's just like, oh, where did they come from? Because I didn't know they were there. Like, what?
Did you? I know you've only just reached the castle. They must have been there, at least some of them there when you got in there. It's like suddenly, oh, look, it's a reveal to the audience, not a reveal to Wormtongue, but it just strikes me as ridiculous.
And then he sheds that tear. And it's
he does.
Like, oh,
tear of love
is that
or
tear
fear.
For?
Or...
What is it for? I need to know.
Yes. It's an interesting one. I have no idea. Is it... Who knows?
Is he regretting having turned on his fellow man? Is he happy because he's on what must be the winning side? I mean, look at all this. Is he feeling
or does he just
scared
have hay fever?
That, you know, he could be turned on and killed at any point himself? Look at all the power this dude's got. I don't know. What is that tear for?
Yeah, it's a very subtle thing, but it doesn't really explain itself in any way, shape or form.
No.
Much like most of the rest of this film at times.
I don't know what you mean. I found this film very straightforward and easy to understand.
Oh, yeah, I knew absolutely everything that was going on all the time forever.
We switch back again to Merry and Pippin in the company of Treebeard, who is going on about trees and Ents and stuff, mainly just to have a single shot of Pippin and Merry seeing the large army leaving from Saruman's castle.
This was a classic example of, hey, we had a longer scene that made a bit more sense, but we've cut it down to these 5 seconds and we're going to put this in so it just feels stilted and jarring and shoehorned and awful, and it feels pointless.
This scene did seem very pointless. We go back into Rohan, where Aragorn washes up on the river's edge. He's not dead after all. He's dreaming about his elven lady friend.
Ghost Arwen kisses him. Yay!
They kiss him, and then he starts French kissing the horse or something.
Yay!
Yeah, that was weird.
That was something.
Well, she gives him protection, and so the protection comes in the form of a horse, and the horse is like, I'm here, and he's just like, I'm passed out. No, I'm here. Look, I'm going to force you onto me if you don't just get on. So I think it's quite a clever horse.
Mm.
And then we switch back to Rivendell and we see the elves. And again, this feels entirely shoehorned into this film. And this is the point in this film where it just put the brakes on and ground almost to a complete halt.
Yeah.
None of it seemed to be moving the plot forward. None of it seemed to really make any difference.
It needed to tell me as well when this was happening. Was this a flashback? Is this happening at current time? What? Because I'm just left going, I don't understand the context of this at all.
Yeah. Again, none in the original books. It was literally just shoehorned in there. I think it's supposed to be happening at the same time as everything else. But yeah, it's just... It's Rivendell, it's Lord Elrond telling his daughter Arwen that there's no point hanging around for Aragorn, because even if he does win and he becomes king and all the other things that you don't know about yet, because, well, you know, we've not got to the third film, he'll still grow old and die and she'll be left alone. So she should come away with her father to the Grey Havens and then off into the West so that they can live forever.
Elf dad is super dumb, by the way. That's a stupid argument.
Yeah.
So we have this entire scene where we basically see Arwen agree that she will go to the Grey Havens.
And then we get a sudden, like, narration moment by Galadriel. What? Where did that come from? Why have we suddenly got Galadriel narration, huh?
It's halfway through the film, so let's have Galadriel explain what's going on to anybody who wasn't paying attention. It did seem a bit odd. It's always struck me as a bit odd, but last night when I was watching it, it struck me as even more odd that suddenly you would have this 5 minutes of Galadriel explaining what's been happening and what's going to happen. It's like, well, where did this come from?
Yeah, I feel like it was everyone's fallen asleep, so we'll do something weird and different to wake them up. So we'll bring in Galadriel for that, and to do that, well, we've just woken them up, so we better give them a recap on what's going on, because they've fallen asleep. It was really odd. It felt
It did
really
seem
weird.
To be, we're halfway through the film, let's give everybody a recap of where we are. Especially after the scene of Rivendell, where everything just slowed right down.
Yeah.
It did seem. So we have that. Then we go back to Sam and Frodo, taken to Henith Anun and brought before Captain Faramir, who is the younger brother of Boromir, who's appearing in this film.
Well, we know him from the first one.
Yes, because he was Sean Bean, so therefore blatantly died.
Yeah.
So they find out that Faramir is the younger brother of Boromir, and that the Gondor Rangers have seen Gollum, or Sméagol as we should now call him, but has been evading capture. They have a scene where Faramir and Sam creep up to a ledge and see...
That was Frodo. And sorry, also, yes. Before that, Frodo blatantly lied to his face that he was just him and Sam.
Yep, nope, no one else, just us.
No one else, no one that else third person hobbits. You saw, nothing to do with us, nope. And then, oh look, there he is. Oh, him!
Oh, oh yeah, I'd forgotten
oh,
about
that
him.
That guy, yeah. Yeah. He doesn't really count.
Yeah. So we see Sméagol down in one of the ponds catching fish and singing to himself.
So Faramir says that that's a forbidden pool and that the penalty for going in it is death. Is he just making that up?
I think he might be. No, it's possible. Yeah, that's certainly possible. Who knows?
I have no idea.
But to save his life, Frodo goes down and lures Gollum, well, Sméagol, into a trap, so he is captured, which kind of is the trigger point for bringing Gollum back.
Oh no, it broke the trust. No.
It broke the trust.
It How could you
him.
Do this to me? I trusted you, Frodo.
Trixie Hobbits. Has...
Yeah.
Faramir tries to question Gollum, but Gollum's too busy having a conversation with himself. At which point the Gollum personality takes back over and he reveals the fact that Frodo has the One Ring.
Well, he just says precious and Faramir seems to get it from that.
Yeah, although there are possibly other bits said that we didn't hear about. So Faramir goes and confronts Sam and Frodo and says that the One Ring shall go to Gondor and be used as a weapon against the enemies.
So apparently this deviates significantly from the books, because apparently, this is what I was reading, Faramir doesn't have this whole succumbing to the ring thing like everyone else, but Peter Jackson thought that that didn't seem to ring true with everyone else and that it should be only Frodo and who's able to resist the lures of the ring. And so
and Sam. Don't forget Sam.
Yeah, Sam doesn't get to wear it in the film though, does he? Whereas he does in the books. And so we have this whole Faramir starting to be corrupted when he's a good man and he doesn't fall to the ring's temptations. And I really feel that's a shame to kind of destroy his character in that way.
Well, he does redeem himself, but yes.
But it shows that it instead tells us that all men are easily corrupted, but wasn't. You know, in the many messages of J.R.R. Tolkien that I don't necessarily agree with, this was one that, you know, I did like, and we lose, which is a shame.
Brownie face.
So we have a scene where we have Aragorn on a horse being taken back to Helm's Deep by the horse, and he just happens to pass the Uruk-hai army and see them heading towards Helm's Deep.
The horse knew where to take him.
Yep. Coincidental coincidence is coincidental. Yeah, so he finally makes his way to... Well, I say he makes his way. He's just hanging on as the horse goes to Helm's Deep. Credit to the horse there, I think. However, he has to tell the leaders of Helm's Deep that there is a big army coming and they're going to be here by nightfall.
Oh, no.
Run away, run away.
Well, there's nowhere to run to. That was the
whole
point.
But the king won't call for help from Gondor because stubborn.
Because stubborn, and Gondor have ignored him in the past, which is silly because, you know, they might not this time.
Yeah.
Stubborn,
well, I mean, he doesn't know that Gondor has its own problems, but still, you'd think you'd at least ask. I mean, an army of 10,000 and you've got literally nowhere to go. They're going to be here by nightfall. Just ask. Nothing to lose. Come on.
But he refuses, so it's just the Rohans versus the whole of the army of the Orcs and Uruk-hais. Oh, they must be just Uruk-hais because they're moving during daylight and Orcs apparently can't do that.
No, because they freeze like trolls, so they turn to stone, don't they?
Ah, okay.
That's super inconvenient.
Yeah, that seems like a design flaw.
Mm-hmm.
We're back to Fangorn Forest, where Treebeard and the other Ents are having an Entmoot council decide what the Ents are going to do about Saruman and the coming war.
Yay!
And again, that scene doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah,
And we switch back. pointless scene. Back to Helm's Deep again, where everybody who is old enough to have a sword and a penis gets given a sword. They already have a penis. That's the whole point. All the men are called into service and all the women fall back to the caves under the fortress.
And Legolas and Aragorn have a bit of a Barney with each other.
They have a bit of a lover's tiff, yeah. Don't they?
And Legolas is like 300 versus 10,000 is hopeless.
So, yes, they all prepare for fighting. They all put armor on. Aragorn and Legolas have a bit of a bonding moment, and Legolas apologizes for complaining about the fact that, you know, they weren't going to be able to win.
They kiss and make
up. I don't know what else he was supposed to do about it. You know, he couldn't run away, so no way to go. That's the whole point. Yep. But
and then a bunch of elves show up. What?
Another comedy moment with the dwarf being too short, and then suddenly a bunch of random elves show up.
Like, this makes no sense. What are these elves doing here? This the elves are off somewhere either. Else. Like, we know this.
The elves were sent by Elrond in Rivendell. A bunch of elven archers from Lorien, led by Haldir. They arrive to assist in the battle, and as is all good British medieval stories, and indeed proves that this is set in England, just as the battle's about to start, it starts raining. including thunder and lightning, which
very, very frightening.
Is supposed to illuminate the size of the army facing them, so reveal Saruman's massive army. But they all had torches anyway, so it should be fairly obvious how big they were. I don't know whether that it seemed to lose impact. Is like, well, they're not hiding their numbers. They all have torches, so.
So the filming of this scene took something like 3 months, and it was all filmed at night, and they had these rain machines on them the whole time. And these extras that were doing all of this, they were put through just so much filming this that at the end of it, they were all given T-shirts that said, "I survived Helm's Deep."
Aww.
Which is nice, but you don't actually want something else, like, I don't know, some money.
Presumably they also got paid.
You think after all that they'd give them a sweatshirt or a fleece with that on so they could warm up again.
Well, this is New Zealand. It's probably
just
quite
give
hot
them
there.
Some soft, warm blankets.
So it's pouring with rain and the battlements are filled with old men and children, and accidentally one of the old men looses an arrow that kills an Uruk-hai, which, you know, this battle is going to happen, whatever. And they're all going on about how the Uruk-hai are hard to kill. Yet this one accidentally released arrow manages to kill an Uruk-hai straight away.
Well, so they weren't ready for it. You know, what do you expect? You've got to be ready for it.
Well, you don't want to let the bad guys get ready.
Yeah.
That's the last thing you want.
The battle begins and there's arrows and swords
and a Wilhelm
and
scream.
Ladders, and there is a Wilhelm scream.
I cheered when we got a Wilhelm scream.
Not only did we cheer, I actually rewound the film slightly and listened to it again.
Oh, beautiful.
You did indeed. It was great.
So they have this battle going on. Meanwhile, because, you know, battles are exciting, but we want to go back to some talking trees as well. we switch back to the Entmoot, where the trees basically say that, yes, they agree that the two hobbits aren't actually orcs. And that's all they've achieved in this time.
And Pippin...
they've introduced themselves.
Yeah, Pippin is just like, oh, okay, well, that's good. And Merry's like, oh my god, I'm so annoyed right now.
Yeah, come on, get your leaves in gear or something.
Merry is not going to take that. Merry's no. Just like, oh no, no, no. So we're getting something done right now.
Back to Helm's Deep, and the battle rages, and suddenly, due to black powder being packed into a culvert underneath the wall, because this is a big impenetrable wall, and yet there's this hole in it that's conveniently the size of a man that has just these metal grates on it.
Well, it's obviously drainage, you know.
Yeah, there's got to be a better way of draining than that. They manage to get black powder into this hole, and then a berserking Uruk-hai manages to shrug off several arrows from Legolas and blows himself and the wall up by igniting the black powder.
Fun fact, the wall blowing up there, and actually in Osgiliath when a boulder smashes into a tower, is not done with digital effects. They're actually literally blowing up the very, very large miniature that they've built for this scene. So that's a real proper explosion.
I love a good practical explosion, it has to be said.
Yeah, yeah.
Me too.
I don't know if the additional men flying around were also digital or practical. Obviously not real people, but, you know,
I imagine it could have been composite.
I've got the death count of the film if you're interested, but we can
we'll cover that shortly. Let's get to the end of the battle before we get to the death count, I think.
I liked the point in this when Legolas used his shield as like a surfboard to go down the stairs while simultaneously firing arrows at people just to demonstrate his superior elfishness.
I did think that was a ridiculous scene, and I've always thought that was a ridiculous scene that always rubbed me up the wrong way.
I think it demonstrates Legolas's personality to us wonderfully. He's like, I am the flashy elf, and I will do all the flashy elf things. Here, look at me while I'm a flashy elf.
So there's a big hole in the wall, which is not according to plan. And despite Aragorn and Gimli's best efforts, the Uruks manage to get through the main gate and the stronghold is overrun.
Yeah, I'm confused. I know, again. They've blown this massive hole in the wall, so why are they still... Well, then, even after they've blown the big hole in the wall, they then get a battering ram to start going at the front gate. And I'm like, you just blew a massive hole in the wall, just go through that.
I don't know if it's actually that easy. I think the whole point being that there is that area behind the wall, but it's still difficult to get into the main keep from there. But yes, no, I agree. It did seem a bit, why have that big area at all if you're, you know, blowing that hole didn't achieve them that much because they still had to go through the main door.
We've done this massive thing of blowing up the wall and then that made no difference at all.
Yeah, not sure. We have dwarf tossing, we have battles, we have people being pulled upon ropes. It's all very exciting. But in the middle of this, we have trees talking to each other. Ugh.
Yeah.
So it switches back to the trees. And the trees who decide not to get involved because, you know, this isn't their fight. This is a fight of men and elves and orcs and not of trees.
I like the trees.
So they decide not to get involved.
I just like the fact that he's like, oh, we'll take you back to wherever it is, the Shire, and then Merry Pippin, I don't know which one's which, it's like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, was like, oh yes, we should go south to Isengard?
Yep.
Yeah.
On this, I wrote that they ask for a different drop-off point, like it's an Uber.
Yeah.
Well, it's fair enough. You know, you're getting a taxi out of the forest. You might as well go whichever way you want.
Yeah, can you just drop us off here? No, we've got three stops on the way, actually. That's all right. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, but it was very clever because obviously they knew. I think there was a whole bunch of extra stuff with Merry and Pippin that was cut out because obviously they knew that the trees had been destroyed and if they took Treebeard south, he was going to get angry and enraged. But I swear there was whole swaths of Merry and Pippin which were cut out.
Thank goodness.
No, and I really like Merry
really,
and Pippin.
There was already five times more Ent in this than I needed, really.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't... You know, not so much N. I like Merry and Pippin.
Yeah, well, they spend their entire film up this tree. So in order to have that, them, you have to have the end.
Back to Helm's Deep, and we have the sad sight of Haldir being slain by some orcs and the sight of Aragorn holding him gently as he dies.
Of who?
And the sight of the Cyrenaimer going... Sorry, who is this bloke?
Yeah. Wait, who's that guy?
He's been in it for 30 seconds.
I didn't even write that down because I did not know. I don't care about whoever it was.
I recognize that guy,
but I don't know why.
I think this was because there's no major character death in this part of the story. They were trying to make a bigger deal out of something that would mean nothing to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can't remember him being in the first film. He kind of turns up in the second film. He's in it for 5 minutes. He dies. Aragorn is supposedly saddened by this, but we don't know who he is. We don't care who he is.
Yeah, I am very confused who he was.
So we're in a situation, basically, it's all gone horribly wrong. Oddly enough, Helm's Deep has been breached. The Uruks are in the main keep, and they're banging on the doors. We then go back to the trees again, because of course we do.
Of course we do.
And this is where Pippin convinces Treebeard to take him south so that Treebeard sees the devastation of the forest, at which point Treebeard goes a bit, you know, crazy.
So he, like, lets out some kind of Ent battle cry, and suddenly there's loads of Ents just pouring out of the forest, like, immediately, Which is
there
why
was more Ents there than in the Ent moot. So where were they all? Where did they? Yeah.
And this is why I was like, what are the odds of them actually having climbed an Ent? Because it seems to be loads of them, and none of these others that are right nearby have been bothered about all these trees being pulled up and used. So
no,
I think they were asleep, weren't they? Wasn't that the whole point? Is that the Ents were asleep, and it sort of took something to awaken them because they hadn't moved in so very long.
So it did just appear that there were suddenly a lot more Ents just appearing out of the, appearing out of the tree work. So the Ents march towards Isengard. We switch back to Osgiliath, which is where Faramir and the hobbits are being held. He says that he will send the ring to Gondor.
Do they actually ever tell us that that's Osgiliath? Because until I was reading up about things after the film, I thought that this must be Gondor, because they'd said he was like, I'm taking the ring back to Gondor, and then they left, and this was where they went.
They showed a map with Osgiliath on it that was a city that was split between two sides with a river through the middle of it. And then they go to the city and say, Osgiliath is burning, and as they look over it. So yeah, it is made sort of fairly clear that it is Osgiliath.
Wasn't clear enough for me then. This the whole sequence in Osgiliath is like, we get these teeny tiny little snippets of it interspersed very quickly with what's happening in Helm's Deep, and the two places look quite similar, and we don't ever get actually told what's going on in Osgiliath properly at all, and I wish that they
you hear that the orcs are attacking. The orcs are attacking from the other side of the city, and the other side of the city's fallen, but we never see much of it at all in this version. I think we see more in the extended version.
I wish for this theatrical version they just not bothered with the Osgiliath part at all, because it doesn't work in this stripped down way.
No,
it doesn't work to the extent that I keep forgetting that it was there.
Yeah.
At all. Like, am I recalling what happens in this story that this entire bit has just fled my memory? Which is why I've been pretty quiet.
We have a situation where Sam has to tell Faramir that the reason that Boromir attacked, the reason that Boromir was dead is because he attacked Frodo because he wanted the ring for himself, just showing that the ring was corrupting people.
Even though that wasn't why Boromir died at all.
No, he died because he was protecting the hobbits.
Yeah.
No, but this is Sam telling someone who is holding them captive and trying to get hold of the ring. It's kind of a, you know, it's not necessarily the truth. This is what he's telling
him. He's using
a
bit of artistic license.
He is indeed.
Yeah.
So this happens. There is an attack happening. Because we've now gone back to the keep at Helm's Deep, and they're like, oh, we have to remember that 5 days on we'll have Gandalf turning up in the morning, and the sun's rising on the fifth day.
The dawn of the fifth day, yes. Look to the east.
They said look to the east, but didn't say what was going to happen at that point.
Because that was kind of obvious. But yeah, it was, how are they going to survive 5 days with 10,000 orcs and 300 plus however many elves?
But it's been a while, it took them a while to get there.
Yeah, the 5 days, I think the 5 days started a while back. So,
oh, okay, fair enough.
Because the 5 days started before they even left the other place on the hill. So there was the travel time to Helm's Deep, and then the preparation time and all that. So yeah, they decide that to make one last stand, they will ride out and face the hordes of enemies, just for a nice cinematic kind of.
Gimli goes and starts blowing on this really gigantic horn, and I didn't understand what that was about.
I don't care. That was the best bit.
it's the Hornburg, which is like the big horn of Helm's Deep. And I think the reason Gimli was blowing on it was because it saved them trying to work out how they would get him on a horse and into battle.
I still don't understand how these horses managed to ride through all of these orcs.
Obviously the horses are made of,
magic.
Magic, yes.
magic horses.
Yeah, they did seem to be quite indestructible.
Yeah. Maybe the horn was giving the horses magical powers.
Ooh.
That's what it was. See, I solved both things in one go there.
Well done.
Thank you.
So yeah, they ride out and they're sort of surrounded and they're attacking things, and then Aragorn stops and looks to the east and sees Gandalf standing there or sitting there on his horse.
And
he stops and goes, Gandalf! And then gets chopped down and killed.
They just stop. there staring and no one like attacks them. What? Yeah. Why would they just pull them straight off the horses and kill them to death?
Yeah, and I agree completely. It was just and then the orcs, the orokai turn around and see the sort of look up as well, and then we have this huge mass of horsemen who are Ymir with 2,000 riders of Rohirrim, apparently, according to the notes.
So only 2,000. So we've got like 5 blokes or something that have just run out of Helm's Deep, and these 2,000 against a force that's still going to be the best part of 10,000.
True, but they're on horseback, and that is a definite advantage.
Right, well, they're fine now then.
Plus, they also have the sort of the magic of the sun on their side.
Fun fact: those spears that the orcs were holding out as the horses ran down the hill straight into them, they were made of cardboard tubes so that it wouldn't hurt the horses.
Oh, that's
good.
Nice.
I'm glad.
Me too.
Because I was a bit concerned about that, and I looked it up.
But I was also the fact that the horses could once again, and this is the same comment I had with the Lion King with the wildebeest, is the horses could suddenly run down an almost sort of sheer cliff. Because that was, I don't see how horses could run down there without falling over.
Magic, by using magic.
That's my
Gandalf's line. Gandalf's with them, so.
We had a situation where the 2,000 horsemen pile down this hill, and just as they're getting close to the attacking army, the sun rises above them and blinds all of the Uruk-hais, and they win the battle.
That was incredibly unrealistic.
Everybody celebrates with cake and lashings of ginger beer.
Yay!
Cake.
Meanwhile, it's Isengard.
Back to Isengard.
Oh
yep,
God,
again, shifting
so
Swedes.
Not over yet!
We have... Yep, Ents attacking by throwing big boulders and stones, and then they break the dam, releases the dam that floods the underground works where Saruman has been building weapons.
Oh, is that what he's doing down forged there? I thought he was just digging out orcs from their birthing.
No, but they also had forges and other things, and that was what was being consumed by the water.
Right, because I
don't understand how the dam was there or why the dam was there in the first place, but,
To stop the water? That's generally why they put a dam in there. They wanted to divert the course of the river.
That seems
because
fair.
They were digging down and destroying, they were deforesting. It's an industrial thing, I guess.
Yeah, it's the whole, the industrialization of the world is going to kill us all, which was something that, Tolkien was very much against.
And it was the most interesting the Ents will ever be.
Yes, including the bloke who was on fire, who then dived under the water to put himself
out.
Yeah,
I think he survived, which was nice. Because I thought when he got set on fire, he was a goner. And no, there was a nice flood.
And now we're back again to Osgiliath, where the hobbits are confronted by a ringwraith on a fell beast.
Oh, Frodo went all really creepy as well, because the Black Riders are there on their dragons. Creepy Frodo, who's all like, oh, the ring, the power, the Black Wraiths, I must do. Yeah.
So this ringwraith turns up, and the ring forces Frodo to walk onto a parapet and holds the ring out.
And where is Gollum during all this?
Gollum is down underneath. He's been held, he's bound and held underneath, pretty much directly underneath where they are, which is convenient. But yeah, he is being guarded by another soldier.
He's not just having a bathroom break.
We haven't seen Gollum since wherever it was with the Forbidden Pool that may or may not have been forbidden. And
I thought we did catch a glimpse of him when they were being herded into Osgiliath.
I didn't see a glimpse.
I don't remember.
I'm sure there was something, but So we have the situation where the ring is about to fall back into the hands of the ringwraiths.
Oh, no.
But Sam pushes Frodo to the ground, and Faramir releases an arrow that pierces the hide of the fell beast, and the fell beast flies off, which begs the question, why didn't they do that in the first place?
Yep.
Mm. They just like pepper it with arrows. There is lots of archers there, just pepper the thing with arrows. Apparently it's really weak on them, but so Sam and Frodo tumble to the ground. Frodo draws his sword and nearly kills Sam before coming to his senses and complaining that he can't do it, it's too hard.
And then we get a really weird interlude.
We then get Sam narrating random stories.
Sam tells us in a kind of meta way about stories to this swelling musical score, while we see a compilation of the victory at Helm's Deep and the flooding at Isengard, stuff we've only just watched, to Sam telling us about stories. It's really odd. I didn't like that. It was weird.
Yeah, it was another narrating bridging device that didn't seem to really work.
I don't remember disliking it as much the first time, but I know what you mean. It's a weird choice, I think.
Yeah. And it also, sort of, he's saying this and Faramir overhears him and goes, actually, I need to let them to go free because obviously, you know. Actually, I don't know why.
Faramir,
I said obviously, but actually this.
Stories. Well, I don't want to be the bad guy.
Yeah.
He's like, oh no, I don't have the right kind of mustache to twirl to be a villain, so I'd better do a nice thing now.
So Faramir is told that if he lets the hobbits go and lets the ring go, that he will be forfeit his life, which he's like, yeah, fine, whatever. Because it never happens. It's, no, whatever. We'll go to the next film and find out.
Yep.
And then we get another scene where Gandalf is talking and saying, oh, war's going to happen because Sauron is going to seek revenge for the defeat of Saruman, and their only hope now is with Sam and Frodo as they resume their journey into Mordor.
No pressure, kids.
No pressure, kids. And when we get the final scene, which is Gollum and Frodo and Sam making their way through the forest.
Gollum somehow is with them again. I don't understand how that happened.
Well, he is their guide, so he would have been let free.
But they were, like, nowhere near each other, and they got out of Osgiliath, where they were, like, in Osgiliath and then suddenly in Forest, and I didn't understand how that happened. And Gollum's with them, and it's just like, what?
Well, no, Gollum was definitely with them when Sam was doing the whole being stabbed in the neck by Frodo.
Yeah, which I didn't understand where he'd come from at that point.
No, I think he was just being held captive. It did seem a little over-convenient, but he is also released and acts as their guide. But we then get a scene where he has another conversation with himself discussing what to do with the hobbits, because he doesn't trust them anymore because they're tricksy, and decides that he can't kill them, he can't attack them at front because Sam is always watching and Sam will be aware of it, but he decides instead to reclaim the ring by feeding Sam and Frodo to her. Although at this point we don't know who her is.
Who is her? Maybe it's, well, there's very few women in this. So her, this far, could be Eowyn, Arwen, or Galadriel.
I think Galadriel's probably the one who eats hobbits.
Yeah, so it's Galadriel.
She's the most likely to eat hobbits, I reckon. Yeah.
So he's going to let Galadriel kill them. OMG!
Yeah, Cate Blanchett, hobbit eater. Yep. Mm-hmm. So yes, we finish with them travelling off into the forest towards Mount Doom. The screen goes to black, and then we have a song. And that's it! Unapologetically, the end of a part two of a three-part film.
Boy, is
body
it
count
ever.
In this film was 468. That is on-screen actual deaths where you see the dead person. 468. This is a very high death count movie.
Many
is
people
this
have died.
Humans and orcs and everything else.
Yeah.
This is including.
I thought it would be higher than that.
On screen, you actually see them dead. 468 is a very high number on the scale of these kind of body count charts.
It's not that high considering how many we had on the Death Star and
Alderaan. Yeah,
but
we didn't see them as dead bodies. We didn't actually see them on screen.
I mean, I would have thought it would have been higher than that simply due to the number of Arrow deaths at Helm Deep.
I think if you start, you know, adding up how many likely did die, it's going to be a much bigger number. But actual, we saw them dead on screen was 468. That's a lot of people who get a dramatic death scene in this film.
468 and one Wilhelm scream.
Yeah,
that's all we need.
Only one Wilhelm scream.
Sure. Perfect.
I really actually like these films. I like the first film. You know, it's one of those things, it's like, I know it's long and I know there's some weird, confusing. Okay, lots of weird, confusing stuff, but I still really like it.
All these things that I'm saying are confusing in this are not confusing at all when I watch the extended edition. So to me, all of these confusing things are problems of it being a stripped down version of the extended edition rather than designed to be this actual length. And that's why I'm picking these faults with it for its confusingness, because that's a choice that they made and it's a problem with it that doesn't actually exist when you watch it properly. So,
okay, that's fair enough. That's fair enough.
So part two of three finished, and I believe part three is also on the list. So we will be coming to that at some point.
Fun fact fans, This was the first sequel to be nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture when the original film did not win the award itself.
Wow.
Did it not win either, though?
No, it was nominated.
If memory serves, none of these films got any major awards until the third
one. They saved all of the wins for the third one, and the third one.
I think
just
it was
sort of
they knew the third one was
going
to be out as well, and so yeah, they didn't want to give it to the second one.
Yeah, this is the first time a sequel was nominated when the thing it was a sequel of had not won for Best Picture, and the reason that we've got 2 and 3 of the trilogy in our little podcast and not the first one is because the first one was pipped to highest grossing by Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, which we've already covered.
Harry!
Ooh, typical wizards. Just getting in the way of each other. Okay, so that was part 2 of 3. We will get part 3 later on. Part 3 being, if memory serves, a lot more long-winded.
It
and
sure
a
felt
lot more
longer.
Endings. So final thoughts. Joe, do you have any final thoughts on this film?
I don't really have any final thoughts. I really like the trilogy. I prefer the films over the books. The books are very tedious and boring in parts. And I really like the interplay between Legolas and Gimli. I think there's quite a good thing there.
Yeah. Daisy, final thoughts.
Hashtag confusing. This film didn't work very well in the way that they had cut it down from the extended version for me. I love the extended version. When I watched the whole thing, all three films, extended version, 12 hours of sitting there digesting this story. But sitting and watching this as a, this is the Two Towers, I've seen Fellowship a year ago, and this is how I'm going into it. No, it didn't work for me, and it really, for me, spoilt the experience of it as a whole, which is a shame, because otherwise I love it.
I do prefer the extended version, I have to say.
Yeah, me too. And Sammy, final thoughts?
Final thoughts. I don't feel like I was confused, but I think there were parts that I zoned out during. Well, I still think it was pretty, as far as a sort of, you know, at times somewhat slow-paced sort of mid-section of a story, it wasn't terrible for me. I enjoyed it.
Good. Personally, I do prefer the extended versions, although that is 4 hours, so it's a lot of time constraint.
You've got to be very prepared.
And as I said, I also wouldn't recommend watching this one, you know, without watching the first one fairly recently. And I guess,
yeah,
I can't remember if the home video versions were out for the first one before the second one was released. I feel
I'm
it possibly was.
Sure,
yeah, because I think I rewatched
sure
it before
were.
I went.
I
coming into this
12 hours if you watch all the extended versions.
I didn't get the DVD though, because I was waiting until all three were out and I could buy the trilogy box set, because otherwise that seemed a bit silly. So I had seen it a year before when I went to see this at the cinema,
which I can see why this would make it
more
confusing. There's so much lore and so much sort of information in the books that didn't make it into the film.
Yeah.
And yet, even then, the films are very dense in information and lore. And, you know, it just...
A lot of it's just not needed. It's not needed to tell us the story that they need to tell us in the theatrical version. Great, have that in the extended edition. But there's some stuff that you just could have cut out completely from this.
Mm-hmm.
I do worry that the point is that they were under, you know... They were fearing that if they cut too much out, people would say it wasn't a proper Lords of the Rings film.
Yeah.
And
it's
a balance
the
between
book
having every...
always going to be like, no, they left out too much stuff, and you don't want to fall too far down
that. I mean, everybody who was prone to these sort of things complained wildly about the fact that the first scene of the third film, which I won't mention by name because spoilers, didn't make it into the second film, and it should have been in the second film because it was in the second book. You know, if people are arguing about that, even though they know it's going to be in the next film, then, you know, it's a real fine line between putting too much in and taking too much away. And I can see why they added in Arwen, because they were very short on female characters. But even so, that bit did seem to drag quite ridiculously.
Yeah,
it just felt jarring. It didn't feel like it was... It's like the bit with Galadriel, as you said. It was just weird and...
Sudden unexpected narration.
Yeah, it just didn't feel like it flowed properly.
It had no relevance.
It was disconnected from the rest of the narrative.
Yeah.
Right, well, that is Lord of the Rings Two Towers. Next time round, we have a older film and a kind of different, but still in some ways the same, in the 1953 Disney animated Peter Pan.
Woo! Oh, I'm excited for this one. I don't think I've ever seen the whole thing.
Which we will be talking about in 2 weeks' time.
Cool.
So until then, I would very much like to thank you for listening to this overextended conversation of us talking about a very long film, but not the longest version of the film, which would be even longer. I would also like to thank my fellow presenters. I would like to thank Joe Carter.
I totally didn't fall asleep. I didn't.
Daisy Swaffer.
Hi, I've been confused.
And Sammy Kelsch.
And I've been basically a hobbit.
They are taking the hobbits to Isengard.
God.
Okay, well, thank you everybody for listening, and we will see you all for Peter Pan in 2 weeks' time.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Home Movie Club, part of the That Podcasting Network. Find us on Twitter at @podcast_thing and on Facebook by searching for That Podcasting. Please like and subscribe for news of our future episodes coming soon.
Theoden's nephew, Eomer, Bones from Star Trek, Eomer. I am so not looking forward to editing this. Theoden's nephew, Eomer, interrogates Grima and realizes that, well, he can't.